Welcome to iDeveloper Live, episode 28. We are sat here on the, is it 1st of September today? Here in the iDeveloper Live studio. There are three of us here in the studio, plus Dave. And there is Mr. John Fox in sunny, I would guess, San Francisco. How are you, Mr. John Fox?
I'm dandy, and this is one of the few times when I say I'm in sunny San Francisco, it's actually sunny.
That's funny. Now, we've not been together for a few weeks. And we will talk about your abandonment of me a bit later on. But there we are. But also in the studio with me, I'm really excited because we have Mr. Simon Wolf.
Hello, everybody.
Now, since we're not doing video, you can't see his sort of head shining next to my head this time. But there we are. There are some things there are blessings for. And we have our honoured guest, rock star superhero, Mr. Marcus Zara.
Hey, hello, everybody.
I just know how much he loves being known as a rock star superhero in the community. So if you want to give any questions to Marcus Zara in the chat room, please just refer to rock star or superhero and we will know who you are talking about. There we are. So lots and lots of things to talk about. It's been about a month since we last did a live episode and put it out there. And a lot's happened in that time. But let's start with what is really old news now, but we haven't talked about it, so it's not been really covered properly yet. The resignation of Steve Jobs as CEO of Apple and his appointment as chairman. So we're going to start. John, what do you think about this move?
Well, I mean, more than anything, I think it has to be sad for him personally. I don't think it's going to materially affect Apple, you know, for at least not for a couple of years. And I suspect they'll make the transition. I just think that you know, here's some guy who put his heart and soul into building a company, and we can all identify with that. Only rock stars of Marcus's level can think in terms of, you know, circular headquarters and whatnot. But, you know, we all can imagine what it's like to put so much love into it, and then he has to step back. And I think that, you know, that's mostly what I've thought about it. And I've enjoyed reading these little snippets of you know, various meetings and stories about Steve. I read one this morning about some guy who was his neighbor in Palo Alto, you know, and who he used to regularly say hello to, and that granted coolness points to the mom in the eyes of the child. So, yeah, that's mostly how I've been thinking about it.
Now, Marcus, I mean, you know, what do you feel about this? I mean, we've been chatting about some business stuff this week when you're together. I mean, does this affect Apple as a business, do you think?
I think it does, but I think it affects them in a positive way because they've been kind of in this vague pseudo-CEO phase for the last 6 months or so since he went on this last medical leave. So if anything, this has said, okay, you know, Tim Cook is now the CEO. Done. He's been doing it for 6 months. There's been no bumps. Things have been going smoothly. We're just making things official. We're finishing the paperwork. So if anything, I think it's more of a you know, solidifying things and just saying, okay, we're moving past this whole medical issue stuff and we're going to carry on with making great products.
So really, it's probably a bit of like business as usual, and this is just the tidy up that needed to be done because this is what's been happening for the last, you know, this year anyway.
Exactly. It's, you know, they've already proven that they can run without him being there day to day. He's still going to have a voice in it. He's still going to be the chairman of the board. He's still going to have an opinion. I mean, it's not like you can suddenly gag him and tell him he no longer has a say in stuff. If anything, you know, Tim Cook is doing the admin.
Simon, please feel free to have an opinion on this as well.
I kind of agree with both of them. I think it's very sad from Steve's point of view that he's effectively taking a step back from his baby, the company that he initially grew and then he came back and saved. But I think for Apple itself, it's good. I think for years now, really, it's been under his shadow. He's been bigger than the company in the public's eye. An awful lot of investors have reacted based on his health issues in the past. And the company is perceived to entirely rely on him, which certainly isn't good for them. So I think the fact that he's finally had to step aside is obviously very sad, but I think it's good for the company. I think it's good for the investors, and hopefully it'll now let the company itself prove that it is more than just the man.
So for a publicly listed US company, what does being chairman mean? I mean, what role has Steve Jobs taken up?
That's a good question. I think it varies depending on the charters for the companies. I'm not exactly positive of it, but he does still get a voice. The board can force things if they want to. But at the end of the day, you know, the company wants to keep the board happy because the board is a representative of the shareholders or the owners of the company. I believe the board is the ones that actually puts the CEO into place. So if anything else, he can, you know, replace top executives if he feels they're not following the board's lead.
So he could bring back Scully if he wanted to.
Yeah, or the, you know, yeah, I think it was the board before that fired him in the first place, wasn't it?
I believe so, yeah.
So, you know, they may not have influence in day-to-day of no, make that pink, but they'll have influence of, you know, stop doing those kind of ads or stop making that product or else kind of threats. Hopefully they don't have to ever go that far, but I think that's the kind of the level of authority they have, gentle guidance and a big stick.
I know often in the UK, the chairman of a large company probably doesn't have that much influence day-to-day on the company. However, they're normally appointed as a figurehead, a well-known figure to represent the company in the public space, to be an identity often around which the company is known in the business sector and publicly, to make the occasional speech and on behalf of it. So in a way, you know, having Steve Jobs, if that's the type of role as well, you know, there just to say, look, I still love this company. I'm still part of this company. It's still part of my heart. And I can still, at a high level, sort of set the tone of this company is, you know, probably for him, very pleasant still to be able to be involved in, and still good for the company.
And definitely good for the, you know, the fanboys and the fanatics, because I think he still gets an opportunity to walk up on stage once a year or so. You know, everybody's still going to go crazy for it, and there's still going to be lines around the block, where it's going to take, you know, Tim Cook quite a while before his keynotes get that kind of a prestige.
Do you think they ever actually will?
To that level, no. I don't. It's going to be, you know, the people who can present like Steve Jobs are few and far between. So I don't expect Tim Cook to do that. I expect him to run the company very, very well. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put him in the position they put him in. But, you know, to be Steve Jobs, you have to be Steve Jobs. You know, he can do one part of it great, but I don't think he's going to be able to fill every aspect of those shoes.
Do you think we will see him up on stage again, Steve Jobs?
I hope so, but I think it'll be cameos.
There's not been a keynote that has just been just Steve Jobs for a long, long time. I mean, there were those days when, you know, Steve Jobs would get up on the stage and 90 minutes later he'd get off the stage and he'd done everything in that keynote. He'd done every demo. He'd said every bit. And yet, even before his illness became public, and maybe even before his illness became near, there was this sense that he was beginning to introduce other people and other people were taking over sections. He became almost the master of ceremonies of the keynote, just giving the headline news and then letting someone else tell about it, which has also been great because they've been saying, you know, I mean, I think that was a very purposeful move that probably had nothing to do with his illness. This was about him saying, there are more people in this company than me.
Yeah, definitely. Go ahead, John.
I was going to say that you know, Tim Cook, I am actually in awe of the logistics and the investments and things like that. And it's kind of funny because it's not something that you would terribly, you know, think of as terribly sexy. But I would say that the things that he does, the, you know, the inventory management and how you manage the relationships with parts vendors and how you know, can kind of almost lock competitors out of a market. He does that as well with as much flair, panache, style, you know, in its own way as Steve Jobs does product design, I think. And I'm curious to know whether anyone thinks that there's going to be a, you know, how things will move now in a post-Steve world. You know, he's obviously going to stay as involved as he possibly can for as long as he can in terms of design, the stuff that I suspect he likes the most. But at some point in the future when that's not the case, I'm wondering if there will be a single tastemaker in the way that he is for products. Or whether it's going to be, you know, small committee or what.
Well, wouldn't Johnny Ive be a good one for that?
Well, I would think. I mean, but I always had the impression that he does it from the pure kind of packaging and physical design of something. I'm thinking about, you know, somebody who says this is what the product should do. You know,
I think the problem for Apple is not now, because I think probably anything coming up over the next 2 or 3 years is already on the drawing board. Already sort of got the concepts in there. The business plan is going there. And to say the business side of it, you know, Tim Cook, great anyway. So I think it's in 4 or 5 years' time, you know, when, you know, maybe Steve has no involvement at all, and you know what's coming after the next generation. I mean, the product line is fairly stable at the moment, and the growth of it. Anything that's going to come along new and just surprise us, you know, in the next 2 years is already in development. So, I mean, it's what comes after that is where the problems may begin.
But even the stuff that comes after that, I mean, if we remember the All Things Digital interview with Steve Jobs when he talked about the iPad and the iPhone and the glass, those both of those ideas came out of the fact that they were playing with a piece of glass, playing with this interactive display. Someone else came up with the, you know, the gravity of the push and the pull and all that of there. And it was only after someone else had come up with that and they looked at it and they're like, wow, we could really do a tablet with this, because that was kind of their long-term goal with it. But once they actually saw all the products and the pieces put together, they're like, oh, we need to do a phone with this first. So even though he was the, you know, the naysayer or the person who got to say no and pick their products, I still think that the, you know, it was the internal people coming up and bubbling up all these great ideas to him, and it was more of him getting to pick and choose versus his creativity standing alone and saying, I have this master plan of where we're going to go for the next 30 years. It's more of him day-to-day going, wow, I've got 10 awesome ideas in front of me. Which one do we want to run with?
Okay, I mean, we're supposed to be a developer podcast, so we're not going to speak about this too much, but it's, you couldn't ignore it, so... We'll start with you, John. We'll just do a quick review. Apple, good hands. Okay, doing going to do okay in the near to middle future. Yes or no?
I think they'll do perfectly fine.
Simon?
Yeah, I think they're going to be fine.
Marcus?
I also agree. I think that things are going to be running great for the next few years, at least.
And for the first time ever on this podcast, there is complete unanimity, and that'll probably be the last time for a very long time as well. Okay, right. Now, John, me and you visited Amsterdam back at the beginning of August now.
Indeed.
And we flew there together, and we used Georg Tuperef's place in Amstelveen, was it? Was that the name of the place? I can't remember its Dutch, yes. Dutch pronouncing, which turns out is about 40 minutes outside of Amsterdam, but it was great.
I'm sure it's
Thank
Dutch
you very much.
For a way out there.
Georg's place. And so we went into Amsterdam to meet up with Mike Lee about Amsterdam and look at the shared workspaces and supposedly see some of the lunchtime talks and see what's going on, meet some of the people behind it. And, you know, it was all great. And we even shared a suitcase because, you know, that's what a team we were. And then you went and left the country on me.
I know. It was a terrible thing. But as I've said at various points, you know, as much as I love my software and I'm proud of everything I've done with it, ultimately, I still care about family more. And I did have to leave early from a medical problem with my mom. Thankfully, everything's fine, but it was quite frightening. I did have to leave abruptly, and I'm sorry for abandoning you there, Scotty. I know how you have abandonment issues.
I know it, but anyway, John, it was important that you left that way. But you took the suitcase. That's where my issue is. You took the suitcase.
Well, I'm sure that you're a grown-up boy there, and that you can find a suitcase, you know, in Amsterdam. If nothing else, you could have like used, you know, a burlap sack used to transport, you know, Afghan hashish or something.
Yeah, it's all right. I went to tourist information and asked about suitcases and got a guide and got it sorted out, so it was okay. So, I mean, okay, so you were only there for about 24, 36 hours, something like that, to begin with. But, I mean, but we did meet with Mike. You did get an idea of meet a couple of the people around. Yeah, what was your impression?
You know, I have to say it was favorable overall. You know, when I think about the whole Amsterdam movement, it has to start with a dream. And, you know, if you consider the dream, you know, what would it be like if you had, you know, a permanent environment like NS Conference? You know, that's a perfectly laudable dream. And I think over time, it's possible to achieve. I think that, you know, a lot of people could say, oh, well, this is just kind of some, you know, fantasy of some, you know, charismatic fellow. And it's easy to see how people could have that opinion. But once you get to meet some of the people who are involved with it, you can see that there are actually a good number of people who are actively working on it. I think the worst thing you can say about it is that it takes time for, you know, if you imagine the dream curve and the reality curve, the dream curve is always a little bit higher, and you want to get them, you know, staying as close together as possible. And sometimes, you know, one will have to, you know, the reality curve has to catch up. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we went there and we expected Monday morning to go to the co-working space that we'd heard about. Well, it's closed on Monday. So, yeah, that seems kind of completely dumb. They're aware of it. They're working on it. But on the other hand, you know, it was not that big an effort for Klaus and the other people to say, hey, you know, we have people and we have developers in town. They need a workspace. Who can help? And they put together one. And you know, it was interesting to be able to see that building that used to be the Dutch national newspaper. I forgot the name, who had moved to a building across the way, and that whole building was kind of quite interesting to see what's taking its place. So, you know, I think it's something that, for me personally, I'm feel very comfortable in saying, you know, this coming summer, barring some unexpected change, I expect to work in Amsterdam. And you know, I just have to work out some details of doing like a housing swap. But for me, it works because I definitely see that there's a good community of developers there. If I need a place to work, I'm sure I can find people who can help me get settled. And it also has the added advantage of keeping me closer to my family, who's in Italy during the summer, and my mom lives in London, my sister lives in Paris, blah blah blah. You know, it makes perfect sense for me, and I can't imagine I'm alone.
No, I mean, I think the great thing about there was, it's very early days, and it's very embryonic, but the point was, you know, we met some good people. It's not just about Mike Lee and big ideas. There's definitely a group of people forming an infrastructure there and beginning to make things work. As Mike said himself, I think, you know, to us, if you don't create hype, then no one's even going to hear anything in the first place, so you've got to have that. And, you know, the workspace, they know there's problems, they're working on it. I think the beach and everything around the workspace, when we actually got down to the workspace on the Tuesday, if I booked my holiday based off the sort of video that Mike made based on the tourist information brochure, I think I would be going to the travel agents union and whatever it is called and making some complaints, because it's not quite as exotic as it looks, I assure you. Although there had been a festival there the day before, which might explain the 17 ton of rubbish on it, but there we are. And for some reason, the porter cabin with the work thing was, we were using the upstairs room, which the three of us who were working there that day sort of crammed around the table. And when I said to Mike, oh, we're using the upstairs room, he said, oh, that's the nice one. It's early. But the point is, there's the beginning of something there. The community in Amsterdam themselves are very keen on it. I went to the lunchtime talk on the Wednesday, and about 20 odd people turned up, and it was a lunchtime talk, and it was great, and people just had a sandwich. Went away again, but it was great, you know, just in the middle of the week, lunchtime in the city, people turned up, hour and a half, went away again. And so I think it's going to be interesting, and I think it's basically, I'm just going to encourage people to sort of, you know, go and engage, go and see what it's like. Don't expect the whole place to be a San Francisco. I mean, San Francisco's had a tech community that's been building up for, you know, 20, 30 years, and it's going to have its time. But if we don't go and we don't start encouraging this stuff, then it's not going to go anywhere. So, go and check it out. Marcus, I mean, what are your thoughts on a community like Amsterdam? I mean, it's, yeah, for you, you're on the west coast of the US. Is it even relevant?
Well, certainly it's relevant. There's a lot of appeal to it. You know, a city that wants us to be there. The city that is, you know, actively hungry to import new, you know, brain, new intelligence, you know. So that, there's a lot of benefits to that, because suddenly we have a voice in the community, which is something I think we've lost on the West Coast. And it's, you know, nobody wants to live on the West Coast anymore. It's terribly expensive to live there. It's impossible to get anywhere. But everybody has to move there because that's where all the tech is. And if we could relocate some of that, or even, you know, I'd hesitate to say all of it, because that would probably just cause the same problem somewhere else. But if we could relocate some of that and get people local to each other that are doing the same kinds of things, magic tends to happen. That's why Silicon Valley was so magical for a while, is you could walk down the street and run across three other people, and all of a sudden you guys put a company together and make $1 billion. If Amsterdam could be the next place like that, where three or four developers get together, they throw up a server, and all of a sudden you have the next Facebook. Why not? I think it's a great idea.
Now, Simon, you're based here in the UK, so I mean, Amsterdam is a more local hop for you. I mean, for us in the UK, it doesn't matter which airport you go from; it's about 40 minutes, 45 minutes in the air. So, I mean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's good. I think it's a good idea. It's very easy, as you say, to get over there and visit. But that kind of takes away some of the temptation or some of the desire to maybe want to relocate there. And I don't know, it hasn't been very clear to me how much Mike is looking to put together a community that sort of lives in and around Amsterdam, or how much of it is just creating a hub where people can go and visit and share the knowledge and get involved in the community feel there. But it's great having something on this side of the Atlantic, something for Europeans, something with a focus that you know, isn't all around California. Fantastic. And you know, hopefully it'll grow and it'll take off and people will go and visit and give input. You know, this is still a very, very early days for it. It's still almost like a child and it needs time to grow and mature. I'll be going over at some point, hopefully in the next couple of months. I think if you've got the opportunity, go and see them, go and lend some support, and just go and see what it's about and spread the word.
Great. So, I mean, that's it. We just need to encourage it. I mean, I think the idea of the community is some will live there. It will become a hub like San Francisco, and lots of people do go and live there. But equally, yeah, and we were talking about this last night, Marcus, weren't we? I mean, you like the fact that, you know, San Francisco is a hub, and you in Northern California just get on your bike and you go there.
Yep.
Because it is a hub, and so that you're a visitor in effect, and going and spending a few days because there is a community there, because there is life there, things are going on. And I think if it could even be made, I know Mike's idea is you don't just visit for the day, you know, come for a month, come for the summer like John's thinking of, and you know, let's make this work easily, you know, anything from, you know, stay in a hotel to some apartments being available to sleeping on a sofa if you're just there for a few days. But the whole point, you can make that easy. You can get involved in the community easily and do that. So, we're just going to say, go for it, Mike. If any of you go to Amsterdam, I'd love to hear about your experiences. So, just drop me an email, Scotty at iDeveloperTV.tv, that is. And it'd be good just to monitor people's experiences. Marcus?
Well, there's one other thought that I had, and it occurs to me every time I come over to Europe, you know, I come over to England as often as I can, but the time zones actually end up working in your favor while you're over here as a developer, if you're dealing with clients, because a lot of my clients are on the East Coast in the US. When I live on the West Coast, by the time I wake up, they've already had 3 hours to be pissed off about something. And then my day usually starts out pretty crappy. But being over here, I get a good, you know, 5 hours or more throughout the day to actually get work done, get things shipped, and can usually head off a lot of those problems. And then when they're finally ready to get up and, you know, get their day going, I'm ready to wind down. So I'm ready to deal with them, deal with email. I get more work done. For once, the time zones are to your advantage when you're dealing with clients, because you get ahead of them instead of being behind them when you're on the West Coast.
Yeah, the only downside is when those clients on the West Coast want to schedule a 6 p.m. call.
Yes.
At the end, on a Friday, to see how the week is gone.
And you're desperately trying to sound professional while you're in the bar.
That's right.
Telling everybody, shh, shh, hang on, I'm going to turn the mute off.
So please do send us your stories on Amsterdam. Take some video on your iPhone or some of that and send us that, and let's see what's going on, and see how we can help that community take off over there. Right, I think it must be time to do something tech.
Must be Simon's turn to talk.
Yeah.
I think we'll defer to the rock star superhero, really.
Oh, there we are. There we are, the rock star superhero. Dave, we need some rock star superhero music for every time we mention Marcus. Oh. We get some sort of, you know, rock star superhero flashing light stuff, if you can do flashing light in audio as opposed to video.
I think we should use, what was that band name, Europe, The Final Countdown?
Oh, yes, apart from we got copyright issues, so we'll have to use a band called, I don't know, there was a band called Asia as well, wasn't there?
Yes.
Maybe a band called Oceana. Was there a band called Oceana? We can make our own up. It can't be called The Final Countdown, so it better be the penultimate launch, I don't know. Anyway, where are we going on this rubbish? Dave, some music in there, please, at some point about it. Because, it's a great pleasure to have the rock star superhero, Mr. Marcus Czar. I was trying to think of something to go in the middle of the two names there, but I just wasn't thick enough.
No.
Thick enough, quick enough. This is going so well. It's great to be live, isn't it? We've been talking all week, or a lot of the week, about Chordata, particularly the changes in Lion and iOS 5. Now, yes. Obviously, we're not allowed to talk about iOS 5 because it's under NDA.
Nope, but we can talk about Lion, and it's all pretty much the same.
But we didn't say that, of course.
We didn't say that, no.
No, not at all, ever. any tour anywhere, so we just need to bleep that bit out. But okay, so what most excites you about Chordata and Lion?
There's two main areas of it that really that I'm looking forward to and that I'm very happy to see, and I can't wait till I actually get to use them. One of them is the fact that the threading has been attacked a lot more aggressively, so that when you are abusing it, you're not in an unknown zone. You don't get to wander around and go, am I using it right in the threading model, or am I using it wrong? Now it's very, very cut and dry. The edge is very, very sharp, but it's very cut and dry. If you're using threading wrong, it will crash. But, you know, just done. It's that obvious. But along with that, making those edges harder, which I think is a very good thing, they've also added additional abilities to be able to get across those thread boundaries, and a lot more threading flexibility in there. And there was things that we were just blocked by earlier, such as, you know, saving to disk. Saving to disk blocked you. It sucked. You were done. If you had a long write to disk, it hurt. And they fixed that. That's now a problem of the past, or a problem of the older operating systems. So the whole way they've gone after threading is one of the two areas that I think is awesome. I just cannot wait to start actually using those in production applications.
I mean, we one of the things we spoke about this week when we were refilming, what people remember, we'd be filming the second edition of the Chordata course here from iDeveloper TV by adding additional material based on Lion and iOS 5. And Xcode 4. But one of the things we're talking about, you know, you do get a lot of emails, you know, many a week you've been saying about, so, you know, my application ran fine under, you know, Snow Leopard and under Lion, it's crashing and I'm getting this weird method. But it is because now, you know, in the past, a lot of the stuff about threading has been advisory, or this is the best practice that you should be using, or this is the way you should be doing it, but it's not enforced.
Right.
Whereas now, if you do it wrong, it throws an exception.
Yeah, it's very hard. It used to be that, you know, if you created a managed object on one thread and you only read from it on the other thread, you got away with it because you weren't doing anything that was damaging or potentially harmful. But now Chordata looks at you and says, you're on the wrong thread. Sorry, crash. And the crash log tells you that, so it shouldn't be a big surprise. You know, cause quite a few of the emails I get are like, no, I'm doing this right. Chordata must be doing this wrong, and they'll send me the crash log. I'm like, nope, you're on two threads. And, you know, I can see the pointer right here and right here. It's thread zero, thread eight. You're crashing. That's, you know, you're doing that wrong. And that was the gray area that a lot of people were in Chordata before, because they thought they were doing it right, but there was no way to say yes or no without filing a DTS incident. And, you know, nobody's going to file a DTS when stuff is working. So, you know, now we're to the situation where things are breaking, and they're breaking in places they should be breaking. And now it's just a matter of us to clean the code up.
Well, I mean, I find a lot of these threading issues, I mean, people maybe sometimes understand that they shouldn't do it on a different thread. But then there's this sort of, you know, maybe sometimes this lack of understanding of things like, let's say, NS operation, for example. And, you know, where is the initializer running? You know, where is the main part of it running? They could be, you know, the initializer is on the thread that creates it, and then the main is running on the thread that's there. And so they're setting up the managed object context in the initializer, thinking they're doing it in a different thread.
Yeah, there's a lot of them like that. Or sometimes where you think that if you turn on the concurrent flag of an operation, you think you're running on the main thread. Well, no, not really. That's not what that means at all. And if you're running on the main thread, it's purely coincidence. So there's a lot of gray areas like that, and this is just helps to clean up some of those gray areas. You know, unfortunately, they're cleaning them up with a bit of a stick, because it's like, oh, you were doing that wrong. Whap. So, you know, that's an unfortunate side effect. But in the long term, it means, you know, a lot more stable code. And we're giving, and, you know, they gave us a lot of carrot with that stick. There's a lot of stuff we can do now. You know, asynchronous saves. Yeah, you know, I was ready to stand up and shout hallelujah when they showed that to us at DubDub.
I think you did, didn't you?
I may have. It's probably on the video. Because that alone is huge.
Is that something you have to opt into, or is there, or if you, or you get for free once you're running under the
line? It depends. For the most part, yes, you have to opt into it. So it's something you have to go in and add to your code. But if you set up as an example, on Lion, if you set up as your true master core context as a private queue context, and then your UI's context, which is the one we usually consider to be the master or the main, is now a child of that private one, Then the private is the guy who's responsible for writing to disk, and the UI is not on the same thread as it. So then you can then tell that private one, the master one, go off and save, and it no longer blocks the UI thread.
I mean,
so yes, it's an opt-in. Yes, you have to code it, but it's tiny. It's a couple lines of code, and boom, now everything works.
I mean, there's a lot of information that you've just sort of said in there that we spent a long time going through on the course, because I mean, now there are different type of managed object context.
Yes.
You know, you can decide, is this a main thread? Is it a private queue or a main queue? And you've just, you know, given a big amount. There are child. I'm not saying you shouldn't give it away, because I mean, it's like, this is well, in the docs. It's like, you know.
You're giving me dirty looks. So.
Yeah. No. It's fine. It's fine. I mean, a Rockstar superhero like you will sell material regardless of it's already been said before. I mean, it's just like the re-release of albums. They just keep selling. This concept of child and parent managed object context. I mean, that's huge. That's a massive thing.
It is. And the thing that has impressed me the most, and it's not that I'm sucking up to the Cordata team, because I just think they've done just a phenomenal job with this release, is they've pretty much changed everything. They've completely, you know, redone our world, so it's a lot easier for us. But the surface area, the points of the code that we have to change to implement these new features are incredibly tiny. You know, I look at the release notes, I look at the ripple and the effect that all this stuff that they've done with the threading especially, and it's like, wow, this stuff is absolutely amazing, and I only have to change, one line of code. And now all of a sudden my app runs, you know, significantly better than it did before. So, you know, it's not only that they've really evolved this thing amazingly, but they've done it in such a way that it has such a minor impact on us as third-party developers.
I think another thing that I found really... not eye-opening, but interesting, as we've been talking about this stuff this week, is the way that the whole use of blocks has been integrated into this stuff. That, you know, really, Apple are saying, you know, blocks are the way we're going to be working, at least in the near future. I mean, almost anything new that's being added to anything that involves anything to do with it, being asynchronous or putting stuff out to be done later or whatever else, everything seems to be about blocks now. And really, so if you haven't looked into blocks, which have been around, you know, in Snow Leopard and before, but if you haven't looked into blocks, then really you're going to start getting left behind in some of these new APIs.
Yeah, you're going to have to look into it at some point, because now some of the APIs, the only way to access them is with blocks. You know, they started off with saying you can do it the old way or you can do it the new way with blocks. They're both the same. Take your pick. Now it's saying, here's a new API, and guess what? It's only blocks. So, you know, they're not as big and scary as they look though.
Simon, are you a block grokker?
I'm getting there. I've just been doing some work with AV Foundation on Lion, which is new to that. And there's an awful lot there, again, that ties in with blocks. So I'm sort of being dragged into it. I didn't throw myself into blocks to start with, but I'm getting there now. And as ever with these things, you realize the value of them and you end up becoming a big fan and using them wherever you can.
In fact, just that's a good point, because Simon's going to come into the studio soon, aren't you, Simon? And do an iDeveloper live session on AV Foundation in line with us, aren't you?
Apparently. I've just found out, yes.
Surprise.
This is the best way. You can deny it if you wish, but there are at least 7 people listening who will hold you to it.
We'll see. No, I'll come in and we'll talk about it at some point.
I mean, so, Marcus, yeah, the every time, I mean, this stuff in Cordata is, let me say, the actual amount of changes we're doing to code we've seen as we've been doing this course this week are very small. I mean, some of them are quite fundamental in the way you think about your code and everything, but they're quite small. I mean, there is a huge argument. I'm just wondering what you're saying. There's been a huge argument going on. And I heard a lot of app developers talking about WWDC of sort of abandoning the normal sort of, I'm going to support this release of the operating system in an old release and, you know, in the previous release of the operating system, because people are sort of saying there is, you know, Lion is actually such a huge step forward. We thought Snow Leopard was a huge step forward, I mean, as a developer release, but now sort of Lion is building on top of these clever technologies to actually build some really, really developer useful stuff on top of blocks and GCD and all this sort of stuff. So, I mean, do you feel there's enough there that if you were setting out on an application today, you would say Lion only?
Oh, absolutely. There was actually some advice that I heard from Will Shipley a long time ago. I'm not sure if it originated for him, but where I heard it first, is that, you know, if users are not willing to give Apple, back then he was saying $129, but now it's $29. You know, if they won't give Apple $29, they're not going to give you a squat. So if they're not willing to upgrade to the latest releases of the operating system, then they're not going to give you any money. Now, granted, you know, there's the fallout of older hardware and things like that, but, you know, that's a small percentage of the people. So if you're writing a new application, if you're starting an application now or have recently started an application, you absolutely should be focusing on Lion. You should be targeting Lion because all the technologies are going to make it so you can build a better application, you can build the application faster, you can get to market faster. And then let the market decide. If, you know, if the market's beating down your door saying, oh my God, we have to have this on Snow Leopard, well, now you've got market input that says, there's a million people outside my door screaming at me. Maybe I should downgrade this. But for the most part, you should assume that the latest technology is what you're aiming at.
The slightly alternate take on that, although it supports it, is that I was talking to some people recently. They were asking me what was new in Lion and why they should update and upgrade to it. And it fundamentally came down to the things like mission control weren't going to be big enough features to draw them to it. And so I then said to them, well, if sort of these applications that you're using were only on Lion, would that be enough to drive you to an update? And they said, yes, definitely. So I think it's a dual role here. Apple have given us fantastic tools in Lion to build some amazing, amazing software. And I think, therefore, it's also up to the developers to start producing software that is targeted towards Lion and takes advantage of them, which will then force users, end users, to keep up to date, update their operating system, and they can then start reaping the benefits as well. It's one of the things that we as Apple, as Mac OS X, and to slightly less degree, iOS developers have over Microsoft, is that Apple aren't interested in supporting years and years of legacy software. They want to keep pushing things forward, and as developers, we need to go along with that. So Lion only, I think, is a good way to go if you're starting something new.
Well, think about it as a developer. Okay, I sit down at my laptop. I've got an 11-inch Air that I travel with, and I've got two text editors that I can use. Well, three of them. I've got Xcode, and I've got TextMate, and I've got BBEdit. And I'm sitting on Lion now. So of the three, unfortunately, I'm going to pick Xcode because that's the one that's utilizing all the Lion features. I can go full screen on it. I can hide all the external windows to the point where I'm utilizing my full 11-inch screen and seeing as much code as on screen as possible. TextMate, close. I can get it fairly close because it, you know, accidentally got a lot of the features because it didn't try overriding the scroll bars or any of that funny stuff. So it's got some of the features, but not all of them. And then BBEdit, a fantastic tool, but it's not yet Lion compatible. So I feel like it's old, and I feel like it's not meshing into the operating system anymore.
I think it's Lion compatible, but it actually doesn't take advantage of the Lion features.
Exactly,
it works on Lion, but it works in the old way.
Yeah, it's still got the, you know, the corner grow window down there. The scroll bars are visible, things like that. It doesn't. It stands out now. It stands out like a Java application on a version 2 or 3 years ago. You know, will they update it? God, I hope so, because it's one of the mainstays out there. But those are just developer tools that are already, you know, sticking out like sore thumbs on Lion. You know, what's our other third-party apps going to look like to consumers when, you know, they're using Mail and they're using iPhoto and they're using all these other apps that are already integrated into Lion, and they're using our Snow Leopard app that's not been updated for it, that it's going to stand out.
I mean, when you say people are asking questions about is it worth upgrading to Lion, I think the answer that I've come up with, or the one I'm using now, which does it to me, is I say, when did you last sit down at your computer and write a document or write a spreadsheet or do something like that, then go to exit the application and it said, do you want to save untitled, and you thought it was something else and you said no and you lost your work? Auto save in Lion. It's worth your $29 if you never do anything else ever again.
And auto versions. I mean, you know, the consumer, the citizen, the normal user can now actually have versions of their document for free. It's not something they have to turn on. It's not something they have to think about. It's automatically versioned, automatically locked if they haven't touched it in 2 weeks. Yeah, that feature, I agree with you, is gold for the, especially for the, you know, the non-developers. Well, developers are probably the worst at it because we don't even pay attention to our keyboard anymore. But yeah, for the non-developer, that's an absolute gold feature.
Right. Okay. We've got a question coming in from the chat room. We just give them a chance to catch up because they're probably a minute, maybe 90 seconds behind the live audio. Abiza, Marcus, is there any case to use SQLite over core data nowadays?
Well, I'm guessing this question has fallen out of the one blog post in the world that I wish I could delete from the Google cache, which would be Brent Simmons' blog post about why he had to stop using core data for NetNewsWire. And that he did produce an actual true edge case of a situation where core data's performance was less than ideal, less than usable for his application, and therefore for his case he had to stop using it. And the answer now, even the answer then, my answer was, you know, you should still be using core data because that's a very slim edge case, and it does not occur. You know, that's one person that's happened once. Now, especially with Lion, that even that edge case is really gone. Because his edge case was he needed to update, you know, a million records and flag one Boolean from true to false on a million records and save them back out to disk, and it caused the entire application to freeze. Now, with our parent-child context, with our private queue context, we can do that very, very easily. And, you know, granted, it's still not, you know, SQLite fast for that one serious edge case that's on the other side of the moon. We can still now do it in an app without without degrading the performance of the app. So, in my opinion, for Cocoa, for iOS, for Mac OS, there really is no reason to be doing SQLite directly anymore, at all, ever.
Okay, I mean, we have in Europe's real Silicon Valley here in Tetbury, we have an app developer who develops some stuff, and he sticks with SQLite because he wants stored procedures. He has no answer.
I don't, because you know that's a kind of a non-starter. You know, it's, I like this wall here because I like hitting my head on it. You know, so okay, leave the wall there.
Who says you don't get good technical quality on this show?
It's, you know, stored procedures are part of a database, so you know, it's kind of stay with the database thing because you know you like stored procedures. You know, I
think there's an element here, though, of what people are used to and what their background is. Before I moved to OS X development, I was a Windows developer. I was doing an awful lot of stuff in SQL Server. And then when Core Data came along, my immediate reaction was, oh, I don't like that. It's not a proper database. And I think until you get out of that mindset and you start to realize what Core Data is and how you should be using it, and it's not a database, but maybe you shouldn't be using a database in the traditional way that databases were used, until you have that epiphany, you're going to struggle with it because you're always going to be sitting there trying to justify, I'd still like to be using a SQLite or another database because I can do this way. And it's things have moved on. You know, Core Data isn't a database engine in the traditional sense. It's way, way better than that. It does way more than that. And people need to start to look at it as a new, different solution instead of it just being a database.
I mean, John, you don't use Core Data in Memory Miner, but is that because historically from when you started Memory Miner as opposed to because it was a choice you made? Or if you were starting again today, would you be using Core Data? What's your thoughts on it?
If I was starting again today, I absolutely would, especially now with some of these issues that I think have now been fixed. But there were things that I found that I needed. For instance, you know, Memory Miner's library format is a document, right? I mean, yes, it has a database and all the thumbnails and whatnot. But if I go to do a save as, and I want to save, you know, 20 photos and 30 people and places out of thousands, it's so much faster in to copy the database and then do a delete. You know, I happen to know SQL very well. I'm very comfortable with it. I know that I can get it done very, very quickly, and I don't have to create an in-memory object graph. And that's the case where I feel very comfortable doing it. And I'm curious to know, Marcus, you know, for things like that, you know, the fact that it's now happening on its own thread and it's not blocking the UI, that's great. Does it still have to kind of create the entire in-memory object graph if you're going to delete something so it does all the validation stuff, or is there kind of a fast delete option, if that makes sense?
For deleting, yes. As long as you play by the rules, as long as you have all your relationships are bidirectional, yes, your deletes will be a lot faster, and and that's getting better and better. You should not see any slow deletes unless you're doing it wrong, is kind of the way it falls down, because it will try to do everything down at the SQL layout level as much as humanly possible. Matter of fact, even migrations, those were commonly an eyesore when it came to core data was SQLite because it was having to suck everything into memory, transfer it over to the new one, push it back down to disk. Where now even that's done at the SQLite level. So there's a lot of things you can do. There's just that one, you know, worst case in the world scenario of I need to change one bit on 1,000 records. And in that one situation, yes, it's still pulling stuff into objects. You're manipulating the bit and you're saving the objects back out to disk. You know, but that's like the one worst case use case. Deleting objects, things like that, that's all done down at the SQLite level. And it's not, you know, you may get the fault, which is just, you know, the skeleton and the unique identifier coming up into memory as an object. But when you're actually kicking off the delete, no, it doesn't pull the rest of it up or have to walk the tree anymore as long as your relationships are set up correctly.
That's nice. Well, then I have another question, because another thing that I did, and this again harkens back to building enterprise DAM systems. So it was a very common thing to say, I'm going to do a search, I'm going to have a lightweight representation of my object, and I'll only fill it in when I need to. And so in EOF, you had something called raw-row fetches. So you could get a dictionary. You could specify which attributes you wanted to put to that dictionary, and then when you need to turn it into a full, you know, enterprise object or, you know, in this case, whatever, managed object, you could do that. And that's something that never existed in core data. Does it exist now?
Oh, that's existed since day one. That's the whole faulting mechanism that's built into core data. When you do a fetch and you request, you know, 10,000 people out of a person table, you get 10,000 skeletons.
You get 10,000 skeletons, but can you specify I want first name, last name, so that I can actually use it? And only if somebody goes to inspect it, then I go do some other things at an attribute level? I don't think you could do that.
I'm trying to think exactly when that came into play. Yes, you can, and I think that came in at Snow Leopard, but I would have to check my notes to be absolutely sure. But there's also a couple other options you have as well. You can pull in as false. You can pull in as fully realized objects. You can also pull in as dictionary, where if you know I'm only ever going to use the first name of this guy, you can just tell it to give you a dictionary with just first names in it, and you can do that as well. So there's a lot of options in there depending on your exact use cases. And I will have to absolutely positively check, but I'm 99% certain that when it came in Snow Leopard, you can tell it, I want these attributes preloaded, and you can define which attributes.
Yeah, my biggest, you know, at this point, I'm sure that I could bite the bullet and not have any complaints about switching over to core data. And my biggest, you know, sadness for not being on core data now is all the replication stuff and all these other things, you know, things that have built up in the whatever the core data ecosphere that I can't take advantage of.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And iCloud and core data. Oh my God. You know, those. Yeah. It's like, ooh, two lines of code, and now I have syncing. You know, take that, Zsync. It's like. So, you know, that part of it is amazing. As for the question about the cross-platform, that's the wrong question is the way I look at it. You know, I get the one question I get a lot is, I need 50 people accessing my database. Can core data do that? Well, the answer is no, of course not. But it's also a shift of paradigm. You know, that's something we did back in the 90s. You don't give people raw access to databases. That's a stupid thing to do. This day and age, you put a service in front of it and let the service handle the 50 users. And then, you could use core data sitting on a server with 50 users talking to it over whatever protocol you so choose. You know, that's the way you want it. That's the way you should be doing that stuff. And you should not be sticking a raw database out there onto the internet and say, hey, everybody have at it. That's a dumb thing. That's just a dumb design in modern day. You really should be putting something in front of it. And if you want to use core data on a server type environment like that, whether it be in a local network or internet, you want to put a service in front of it. And the service should be the single thing talking to the database. And then the user's talking to the service. But if we're talking about cross-platform and the fact that I want to write an application that will run on Android and an application that's going to run on Cocoa and an application that's going to run on Windows, blah, 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 then again, that's the wrong question to ask, because you should be leveraging the features of that. I think cross-platform is a dumb idea. In that sense, if you're going to be writing two applications, one's running on Android, one's running on iPhone, you should be writing two separate applications. Can they take a lot of designs from each other? Yes. Can they take a lot of formulas and optimizations from each other? Most likely. But they should be working on the strengths of each platform that they're being built upon. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a Java application, which sucks everywhere. And that's not what you want to do, because then your iPhone app is going to suck, your Android app is going to suck, and everybody's going to hate you. you know, leverage the data structures. Yes. You know, leverage the ideas and the concepts and the goals. Absolutely. But, you know, write one in Java, write one, the other one in Objective-C, and the persistence and the data model is dictated by the language and the platform, not by us trying to save 5 bits.
Here, here.
There we are. That's good. Okay, we're drawing close near to the end of our time, so we will start to close down on that now. But, I mean, Marcus, tell us about one more thing that you love about Chordata and Lion that wasn't there in Snow Leopard.
iCloud. I am so excited about iCloud. Now, mind you, it has opportunities because Apple has made strides into this area before, and in some of them they did fall down rather glamorously and on their faces. But I think that they're coming at this from the right direction. I think that the iCloud is going to be brilliant, and if you're not using it a year from now, everybody's going to laugh at you. I think we should all be embracing this thing and looking at it, because this, you know, when I wrote Z-Sync, I said this belongs in the operating system. This really needs to be in the operating system. It's dumb to be doing this at the application level. Apple has put it in the operating system. We need to embrace it and absolutely love it.
Great. Well, I mean, we probably need to do a session on iCloud at some point when you know, just to bring people up to speed on that and whatever else. And we'll probably wait for iOS 5 and that one as well, so that we can do it all together. Right. I think we're going to start bringing that to an end, because we've been on air for an hour and we'd like to keep it to under an hour if we can, just to, for the sanity of all our listeners. So thanks to the chat room for asking a couple of good questions. You've been a bit quiet in there tonight, actually, chat room. Maybe we need to, it's because you've had a break and we need to get some of your banter back going again. Although I think a few of you did start a private conversation at one point, which is always very interesting. It keeps us entertained when one of the guests is being very dull or something. Anyway, so let's start. I wasn't looking at you, Simon. I wasn't.
Yes, you were.
Oh, I was. Sort of, you but just not, happened
I don't
to
think
be,
you meant him. You were looking at him.
You just happened to be the other side of my iPad as I looked up.
And people wonder why we come on this show.
You know, people wonder why you come on anyway. Anyway, so let's just wrap this up by Simon. Let's start with someone really important. Tell us who you are, where people can find your writings, and maybe leave us with a pearl of wisdom, just because I want to put you on the spot.
I'm Simon Wolf. My company is Otter Software, and you can find the website at ottersoftware.com. You can find me on Twitter as SGAW, also on Google Plus as that, although is anyone even still using that? Pearl of wisdom. Wow. Start using the new APIs in Lion. That's really it. Huge amount of fun going through some of them at the moment and uncovering some real gems.
Great. John, you know the routine by now.
Yes. Well, my name is John Fox, and you can find out all about my product Memory Miner at memoryminer.com. You can read about my experiences working on it at memoryminer.com/blog. You can follow me on Twitter as Djembe, D-J-E-M-B-E, like the West African instrument. And my pearl of wisdom is get to know and love the joy of getting rid of old code. And the only way you can get rid of old code is to pull out stuff that you had to write before there were Apple provided APIs for it. It's a lovely, grand, and wonderful feeling.
There we are. I'm sitting here thinking, I love that feeling, actually. Nothing like deleting a bit of code until you realize it was the bit you actually needed, but then it's totally the opposite effect. But never mind. That's why we have version control. Superstar, rockstar.
Oh, okay. Mark Azari. You can find me at Coco's My Girlfriend, AIMGF.com, as well as on Twitter at MZara. And my pearl of wisdom, I had one, and then Scotty decided with that superhero nonsense, would be to embrace the APIs. Don't try to reinvent them. If you're reinventing something that's already in the API, you're swimming upstream and eventually going to get caught by it. So don't think you know better than the guys who've been writing this stuff for a living. Assume that if they wrote it, it's probably going to be faster than what you're going to do.
Right, my name is Scotty. I'm from iDeveloper TV. You can check out our stuff at iDeveloper.tv on the internet. On Twitter, I'm at MacDevNet. I just want to say thanks for Dave, who's fallen asleep in the engineering chair here. If it sounded beautiful tonight, it's obviously got nothing to do with him because he's been sleeping. But it may sound beautiful because he bothered to set it all up, and we've all got nice new shiny headphones, and they're all very comfortable, actually. So thank you very much, Dave.
Taking mine home.
My pearl of wisdom? Oh, I don't know. Don't eat American cheese. It's disgusting. Right. Until next time, we will see you on iDeveloper Live. But until next time, you take care. Thank you.